Inbound Ideas, I'm Ryan Denham. Let's run down some of the day's top stories. Two more McLean County residents have died from COVID-related complications. The latest fatalities are two men, one in his 40s, the other in his 60s. Neither were associated with a long-term care facility. The death toll is now 210. The number of McLean County residents hospitalized with COVID held at 43, but just 1% of all Bloomington Normal Hospital beds are now open. That's the most constricted bed capacity since the health department started reporting those figures last November. Some Bloomington landlords are getting stuck with huge water bills their tenants aren't paying during the pandemic. Water shutoffs have been on pause for the last year to protect people economically hurt by COVID, but some landlords say tenants are taking advantage of that opportunity. That means landlords are on the hook for months of unpaid bills. Deputy City Manager Billy Tyus says he understands their frustration.
Ultimately, it is the property owner that is responsible for the property. Having said that, we have worked to try and create programs in a situation where there's flexibility in payback for some of the things that could be owed.
Tyus says the city is working with landlords to avoid liens on their property. He says possible solutions include lowering the minimum payment to keep the account current. He says the city will also consider lifting the moratorium on shutoffs, but he says they'll have to weigh the economic and public health implications. And former Bloomington City Councilmember Jim Fruin says he does not plan to seek a recount in his Ward 9 race. Fruin trails ISU professor Tom Crumpler by just 19 votes. The Bloomington Election Commission says 20 outstanding ballots in that race have been returned since the election. The commission says there are 29 more ballots that could be counted if they were postmarked by Election Day. But Commission Executive Director Tim Mitchell says it's unlikely they'll get many more. Fruin is a real estate agent who served 10 years on the city council previously. Find more stories at WGLT.org.
Support for WGLT comes from Bloomington Normal Audiology. BNA's educational video series, Hear My Story, continues with local patient Gina Barnhart.
They truly have changed my life. I have a better quality of life, and to just be able to have the empowerment that I have and the confidence that I've been able to gain.
Gina's full story can be found at bnaudiology.com.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Republicans and Democrats are at odds over a sweeping election bill that seeks to reform voting, campaign finance, and ethics laws. The For the People Act passed the House last month. Just one Democrat sided with unanimous GOP opposition. Republican Congressman Rodney Davis says Democrats claim the bill prevents voter suppression. Davis says that doesn't tell the whole story. Dana Vollmer reports.
Davis calls the measure a Democratic power grab that reaches far beyond voting rights.
This is not a For the People Act, as it's titled. This is not a voting rights bill. This is a For the Politicians Act. And this is the furthest thing from a voting rights bill that we can get to, because really what this bill does that doesn't get a lot of reports about it is that it gives every single member of Congress the ability to get $7.2 million put into their own campaign accounts.
The bill does empower public financing of congressional campaigns by creating a voluntary small donation matching program through a so-called Freedom from Influence Fund. A similar program already exists for presidential candidates. The fund would provide a 6-to-1 match. For every $1 a private donor contributes, an additional 6 would come from the fund. Donations are capped at $200 per donor. That fund would accumulate money primarily from surcharges on federal fines, penalties, and settlements from corporations, corporate officers, or in rare cases, individual tax code violators who are in the top income bracket. The legislation specifies no taxpayer dollars can be used to support that fund. Supporters of the measure say it will diminish the power of PACs and corporate wealth and help bolster diversity in who runs for office. That's just one part of the 800-page legislation. Davis says he believes the parts that tackle voting rights are also problematic.
Remember, the voting rights portion of this bill is to expand voting procedures that have been ripe with fraud, like ballot harvesting, a process that has already been deemed fraudulent in North Carolina's 9th District. We didn't sit a duly elected member of Congress there because one of his operatives used the ballot harvesting process that was illegal in North Carolina. However, if that individual who committed fraud in North Carolina and did that fraudulent activity in California, where ballot harvesting is legal, nothing would have happened.
Ballot harvesting, or ballot collecting, is when a third party collects and delivers ballots on behalf of voters. Davis is referring to a 2018 North Carolina case where a Republican operative was indicted for mishandling absentee ballots in an effort to sway the election. The operative was charged with paying workers to collect ballots from voters, fraudulently sign them, and then deliver them to election offices. North Carolina law only allows close family members to return ballots on a voter's behalf. Fraudulent signatures, meanwhile, meanwhile, are illegal in every state. In about half of states, third parties like volunteers or campaign workers can go directly to the homes of voters, collect completed ballots, and drop them off at polling places. And in some states, ballot harvesters can be paid to do that work, but not in California. Illinois does allow third-party ballot collection, but requires authorization, usually by voter signature. Supporters say this process is critical for voters who may have trouble accessing in-person voting or where mail service is scarce. That includes those living in rural communities or who lack access to transportation. This bill would allow voters to designate any person to return a voted and sealed absentee ballot, as long as that person is not being compensated. There's no limit on how many ballots the third party could return. There's little documentation of widespread election fraud by either left or right interests, but Davis says Republicans are still concerned about security issues, particularly with expanded mail-in voting.
There are states like New York and California, Nevada, and others. They mail live ballots out to every registered voter, and here's the problem with that. We even identified this with the former Secretary of State, now Senator from California, Alex Padilla, at a hearing last fall. Secretary Padilla would not commit to removing identified deceased registered voters off of the voter rolls in California and thus abide by the federal law in the Help America Vote Act by making sure that voter rolls are up to date. He would not commit to removing those deceased individuals. You're talking a few hundred thousand individuals that have been identified. They all got live ballots sent to their last address.
The bill does not mandate voting by mail. It requires states to send out vote-by-mail applications, not live ballots, to all voters. California did send live ballots to all registered voters in November. An elections watchdog group claims that could have sent 458,000 ballots to voters who are dead or have moved. That was the number of registered voters who had not voted or updated their registration since at least 2008. Election officials dispute that idea. They say they use transmission of death notices, state and national change of address information, and incarceration records to regularly update voter lists. However, they admit erroneous ballots will be mailed given the time it takes to receive those official notices. Still, Davis has concerns about the feasibility of expanding vote by mail.
We have to be able to hear from election administrators, which is why I had the Secretary of State from Washington State as our witness. They vote by mail 100%. But she is the first one to admit it takes longer than 5 years to implement a system like they have in Washington State. It can't be done overnight, and it can't be done at the expense of making sure the chain of custody of every ballot is paramount.
Again, the bill does not require all voting be done by mail, but state and local election officials are worried about their ability to meet the deadlines and requirements as laid out in the legislation. Many of those boxes are supposed to be ticked as early as next year, and they say some measures would significantly increase the price to run an election with no guaranteed long-term funding. Davis says these are among the reasons voting reforms are better left at the state and local levels.
We have to celebrate what we're doing right, and that's really what the Democrats in Washington don't want to do. They don't want to acknowledge that we've had record turnout, and that matters. And that shows that states and localities are actually implementing provisions that are encouraging people to vote. Otherwise, we would have seen less people able to vote. And that's a good thing. But let's leave it up to our states. Let's leave it up to our local election officials to actually administer elections in a way that's going to benefit them and their constituents.
Leaving it up to states is exactly what Democrats fear. There are more than 350 election laws under consideration in 47 states that Democrats and some scholars call restrictive. That's according to the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University School of Law. Researchers there say that's a 43% increase in the past month. Those bills would do things like eliminate or restrict early voting, tighten or impose voter ID requirements, prevent same-day voter registration, and allow for bigger voter purges. The federal step could hypothetically put a stop to all of them. But success looks unlikely. The bill would need to win over a minimum 10 Republicans in the Senate to break a filibuster. That is, unless lawmakers scrap the 60-vote threshold as progressive Democrats are calling for. Until or unless that happens, both parties can point to the issue to mobilize their bases. I'm Dina Vollmer.
You're listening to Sound Ideas on WGLT. It's easy to see that the municipal election in Bloomington did not go well for progressives. The People First Coalition went 0-4 at the ballot box, as more conservative and centrist candidates won. Progressive candidates tell Eric Stock they believe they delivered a winning message, but a political scientist says they need to moderate that message if they want to get elected.
Jackie Gunderson was at the top of the Progressive ticket. She came in third in a three-way race for Bloomington mayor. Gunderson oversees capital projects at Illinois State University. Gunderson says the election was a first for many in the Progressive movement, a first for the candidates, volunteers, and even some voters.
We engaged people that had no idea there was even a municipal election going on. And for me, that's a win. Getting people to turn out in record numbers. That, for me, is a win.
This was Gunderson's second campaign. She unsuccessfully ran for a McLean County board seat in November. Current Bloomington City Council member Jen Carrillo helped lead the Progressive Coalition, though she says she doesn't speak for the candidates. Carrillo says these election results reflect a typical political cycle.
In Bloomington, you saw some very progressive candidates elected in the last cycle, and I think now you're seeing the backlash of conservative candidates being elected to counter that.
Carrillo suggests upset Donald Trump supporters were more motivated to vote after he lost in November. Though Trump voters alone could not have made the difference, the ex-president lost Bloomington to Joe Biden by 15 points. Carrillo also accused opponents of using scare tactics on the issue of police funding. Eric Rankin is a former chair of the McLean County Democrats who works at ISU's Department of Politics and Government. Rankin says running all the progressive candidates as part of a coalition was risky.
One of the problems with coordination and jumping all into one camp is that you do tend to sink or swim based upon how that group does.
The progressive candidates say the coalition helped them pool resources and unify their message. Progressive Kelby Cumston lost to incumbent Molly Ward in Ward 7. That's northwest Bloomington. Cumston is a project manager in affordable housing construction. Cumston rejects the everyone sink or swim theory.
I think that the progressive movement has only just begun. I think that there are the center-leaning political organizations that have existed for decades and decades, and honestly, this feels like the first time a progressive slate has been tried in local elections.
Political scientist Eric Rankin says the progressive candidates also lurched too far to the ideological left to win.
A pure progressive slate will not be successful in McLean County without moderate Democrats to help bolster the numbers. It's a simple matter of math.
The progressive candidates say they stuck with their convictions. Patrick Lawler lost his race to Nick Becker for Bloomington City Council in Ward 5 on the city's Near East side. The Bloomington Police Union backed Becker. Lawler says he wanted to be a voice for those who have had problems with police.
Those problems exist, and I guess rather than what's expedient or politically expedient or politically popular, like all of us in the People First Coalition, we were more concerned with standing up for what is right.
Candidate Kelby Cumston says even if the coalition didn't win any races, they forced the other candidates to address issues important to them.
And I would say for sure that the PFC controlled the entire narrative of this election season in Bloomington, for sure. I think a lot of the questions and forms were all based on the campaign issues that we were running on.
Whenever an election is over, talk usually turns to unity. How do opposing sides put aside their differences for the common good? Councilmember Jen Carrillo made clear she has no interest in that. Carrillo posted on Facebook she plans to make the lives of two of the newly elected council members a, quote, living hell for the next 2 years. Carrillo also called election winners Nick Becker and Sheila Montney dangerous authoritarians who were essentially paid off by the Bloomington Police Union. The union backed their campaigns. Becker and Montney both made public safety a key part of their election platforms and have said those contributions won't affect their judgment as council members. Carrillo says those who demand unity apply a double standard.
When the mainstream narrative is one that leaves out people of color, leaves out people with disabilities, leaves out women and folks of different sexualities and gender orientations, then of course, like, unity around the mainstream sounds really, really nice to the folks who are included in the part of that mainstream.
Unlike normal, where council candidates are elected at large, Bloomington council members are elected only by voters in their ward. Carrillo represents Ward 6, which covers parts of downtown and West Bloomington. Political scientist Eric Rankin bristles at Carrillo's rhetoric, but he says Carrillo has made clear what she believes. He says for her, it has worked.
If you're going to find a candidate like Jen tends to be more successful in her specific ward because her specific ward has a bit more of that profile than really any other ward in Bloomington.
People First Coalition candidates say they still need to dive into the data from this election and see how they could do better in the future. Mayoral candidate Jackie Gunderson says each of the candidates was already advocating for progressive causes before they ran for office. She says they will still push for ways to bring about change, even if it's from the outside looking in.
All of the things that I was passionate along the way don't suddenly go away. I still want to see those things come to fruition, especially the places where our vulnerable neighbors are slipping through the cracks.
And Councilmember Jen Carrillo calls for progressives to take the long view. She says it takes decades to build political power. She says they're building a movement, not a moment. I'm Eric Stock.
The new council will be sworn in May 1st. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. It's been a long year for anyone connected to a nursing home, the residents, the staff, and the loved ones who couldn't come to visit. But hope is on the horizon. The vaccination effort has waved over residents, and now there's only one active outbreak at a McLean County facility. Angie Baker from the East Central Illinois Area Agency on Aging is an advocate for nursing home residents. She says many residents were largely confined to their rooms this past year. That's where food, activities, and care were delivered.
I know as we are starting to go back into facilities and talking to folks, there's not a one that hasn't experienced a roommate or a friend down the hall that has gone into, say, a memory care unit because of the decline in their social health, isolation, as well as their own physical and mental health, even if they didn't require additional care. It's been extremely hard on residents.
Where are those times where you've had to not step in, but play the role of advocate for someone related to the pandemic?
I would say a lot of them have to do with things like, remember, they're in their room only. That's the only control they have. So food is delivered cold, and which the facility is happy to address, in all fairness. Number one thing we've advocated for over time, there's been different levels of visits that are allowable depending on the status of COVID within that building. So we've done everything we can to get compassionate care visits, which are allowed if COVID is present in the building, for the health and the welfare of a resident.
How would you characterize kind of the overall staffing challenges that you've seen in McLean County facilities at this moment?
So maybe we're going to call it a staffing shortage to some degree, which then means a reliance on agency staff, which isn't inherently a bad thing, but they don't know the residents. They don't know their personal needs and care and routines. And so it's not deliberate, but it's just not as sufficient. Certainly attracting employees to stay involves a good compensation package. And we just have some companies that don't make that attractive or competitive. And so you can get a job, three different job offers in a different facility in the same town in one day during this time.
How are vaccinations going in the nursing homes we have here in McLean County, both for residents and employees?
So a really important question. They're going great with residents. There was a high compliance or acceptance, very high, and we see it on the news. The measured outcome is a dramatic decrease in hospitalizations and severe illnesses for residents. So it did what we wanted it to do very effectively. The problem is staff have not been so accepting of getting a vaccination, and I'm not going to pretend to understand the why of that, but it has a dramatic impact on residents again because COVID potentially is coming into the building via employees. That causes a shutdown of that building, whether it be temporary, if it's just some sort of an isolated case, and I won't get into the regulations on that. But otherwise, they go into a complete shutdown. So you're not going into the dining room. You're not going out of your room again. It's devastating. And I realize there's personal choice, but it is so devastating to residents.
Well, at some point, the pandemic will be over. Families will be making choices again about nursing homes and other long-term care facilities, and what is a good fit for my mom or my dad or my uncle or whoever it may be. Does it say anything about the quality of a place, what happened with COVID, or was just COVID a wave that washed over everybody?
Honestly, it could be both. I think it's hit what we'll call great facilities, and I think it's hit what we wouldn't consider the best facility. I think staffing has a bigger impact on that, and typically your great facilities have a handle on staffing, probably compensating better employee retention. So probably maybe not as competitive at another facility, which then means you're rotating staff, and that compromises the safety.
That's nursing home advocate Angie Baker from the East Central Illinois Area Agency on Aging. Lawmakers want to change how people get insurance company approval before medical treatment. Advocates say the current process harms patients. Christine Haffold reports it's a reintroduced bill after the previous one stalled during the pandemic slowdown in legislative work.
The bureaucratic term is prior authorization. Doctors have to clear certain prescriptions and procedures with insurance companies before they go ahead and help patients. The bill would force insurers to put information on their websites about prior authorization requirements and restrictions for specific procedures. It also limits how long providers can take to approve or deny a request. A doctor who has knowledge of the issue at stake would also have to review appeals. Dr. Robert Panton is the president of the Illinois State Medical Society. He says prior authorization isn't a bad idea. Or at least it didn't start out that way.
The entire concept of prior authorization started as a reasonable concept to help direct care and to focus care in certain directions. It's become an extremely onerous tool.
Panton says current procedures can block healthcare providers from giving patients care they need. Nicole Robinson is the vice president of patient access with OSF Healthcare. She says there is now no standard on how long it can take to get an authorization.
No one wants to get a diagnosis of cancer and have your doctor prescribe a treatment plan and then wait up to 2 weeks to hear whether or not, you know, your doctor's approved treatment is actually going to be approved by your insurance.
Authorization delays have even led to patients giving up on getting needed treatment. That's according to Dr. Paul Peterson. He is the chief medical officer at OSF St. Joseph Medical Center in Bloomington, and a former president of the State Medical Society. Peterson says doctors are in an uncomfortable position.
You have to say, I'm sorry, we can't do this yet. It has to be delayed for a period of time. It's not a pleasant conversation.
There may be more than just red tape delays in operation. OSF Patient Access head Nicole Robinson says some insurance companies have turned prior authorization into a cost-saving tool.
Sometimes they will give us an authorization and then later revoke that authorization even after the service or the provider has provided the treatment, and then we're stuck with trying to figure out what to do with the bill.
That can put the cost on patients who might not be able to afford it. Many medical associations across the state support the bill. Robert Panton of the Illinois State Medical Society says both Democrats and Republicans sponsor the bill.
This is a bipartisan approach. It's an issue that affects just about everyone or their families or their friends. And it is so many people are influenced by this.
Panton says the insurance companies themselves are the biggest obstacle to the changes. But he says those providers aren't always opposed to these kinds of bills.
Sometimes when you have fair regulations that apply to all insurance companies, we use the expression it levels the playing field. And it may actually allow them to be more supportive of it.
Blue Cross Blue Shield of Illinois, one of the state's biggest health insurance providers, would not comment on the bill. In a statement, the company said it is, quote, committed to working with our community of providers to help ensure that our members have access to benefits for quality, cost-effective health care that is both timely and appropriate. I'm Christine Hatfield.
Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible in part by Bloomington Normal Audiology. I'm Ryan Denham. We had story help today from Dana Vollmer, Eric Stock, and Christine Hatfield. You can subscribe to the Sound Ideas podcast at WGLT.org or find it on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or Google Podcasts.